Welcome to the Guardify Real Evidence Podcast, where we dive into topics related to the digital evidence landscape and how technology, people, and processes come together to unite communities towards restorative justice. My name is Myron.
And I'm Ashley. And our guest today is Ben Jackson, CEO of Guardify. Hey, Ben, how's it going?
Hi, Ashley and Myron. Today's a good day. I'm excited to be here. I'm so pumped about this podcast and just the fact that we've gotten this thing off the ground and we're able to celebrate digital evidence management in a unique forum. I think just like being able to take an idea that we talked about in a conversation room and then being able to bring this to fruition and share, you know, different opportunities to expand the collective intelligence insight about the industry, how digital evidence management, the landscape is changing, our customers, and like all of the different things that we hold true and hold to be super valuable just out in the world. I think it's really cool. So thank you to both of you for inviting me, but super excited to be on the podcast. Thanks for having me.
Well, Ben, we're really excited to have you on the podcast today. In our last episode, Myron and I kind of talked a lot about what our views or our insight was on why we're doing this podcast. And I think it'd be a really good idea to have you give us a little bit of information about you, what you see for Guardify and how you became CEO here.
Yeah, it's a complicated question, but I'll try to simplify it down a little bit. So I had the unique privilege of meeting my predecessor about 5 years ago. Her name is Sarah Boyd, who started kind of the commercialization of VitaNix, which then later became Guardify, through some mutual relationships in our community here in Omaha. Our headquarters is in Omaha, Nebraska. And I got to know Sarah. I got to understand a little bit more about what VitaNix did for the world, what a child advocacy center was. Quite honestly, I was fairly ignorant to what that meant. I didn't really understand the incredible direct service workers that were in my own community, in my backyard, the people that were supporting them. And kind of through that last 5 years, talking to, you know, to her and several other members of the team over the course of time, I realized there's this unique opportunity to connect folks who have had really strong digital experiences, who are technologists, who know how the internet works, who know how some of these modern technology platforms that people kind of throw out and in meetups and in bars and coffee shops and pretend like they know what they're talking about. And then there's like a subset of people that don't talk about it much, but actually do the work and know how it works. And then this other side, which is direct service providers, people that spend all day long serving people in relationship, asking questions, being in their community, serving people through whether it's law enforcement, whether that's your litigation services, people who are in social services and in our world, child advocacy centers, prosecutors, defense attorneys. And I kind of realized like there's this natural ignorance in the world where we believe that you can only do one thing. You can only build great technology companies and make lots of money, or you have to be on the social side where you don't make any money and you sacrifice everything to go do social work, or you go do, you know, to the good of society, things for the good of society. My wife being a teacher, I've learned a lot about this over my years. What I found to be true at VitaNix and now Guardify is that we believe very strongly that you can do well financially. You can do well by building great technology that people want to exchange value in. They want to pay money. And you can also do good in the world. That you can actually put those two things together. You can also build sustainable businesses that are built on social impact. And so as I learned more, got the chance and unique privilege to meet with her. I met with several members of the board, got to know some people, some customers, talked to some customers outside of our business before I joined the organization. Uniquely, I had the privilege to talk to my uncle, who's a former district attorney up in Madison, Wisconsin. And I talked to him at length about what his experience was like, what it was like to have to handle, you know, an incredible caseload, what technologies he'd wish he had, things like that. And I kind of asked him the one question. I always go like, if you could just wave a magic wand and have somebody solve your technological problems that would make your life better, what would that look like? And then as he shared more with me, I just realized how big of an opportunity space this really was, that there was lots of different folks that wish that technology had really like jumped into the space many, many years ago to help, to serve this group of, you know, incredible human beings that are just saying, hey, I'm just trying to make it through the day through these traumatic events. And the worst thing in the world is I have to use this archaic technology that breaks constantly, costs a lot of money, doesn't really make sense to me that somebody's forcing me to use that I don't really like. So really taking a different posture on that is really exciting for me. So that's where I came from. My background, I've been in tech for almost 20 years now. I worked at LinkedIn for a long time, when we were not a household name to when we were a household name. I've worked at a couple of other technology companies before. They're a very large website hosting platform before, where I learned a lot about different web applications that can be used for incredible purposes, but also there's a dark side to it. I learned there's also, for every world-class website, for every world-class technology platform, there's somebody else who wants to use it for nefarious purposes. And so I had the privilege of being on kind of on the front lines of policymaking when we were at LinkedIn, and as we were starting to engage with government agencies, law enforcement, kind of creating the first algorithms that could detect certain types of images on the internet, back, you know, generations ago now. But it's fun to actually go back in time and go like, remember when we actually had to figure out how to take a picture of a thing and then actually write a, you know, a complete code to identify every single pixel on that image, so that you could map it out and test other things against it, what was on that image. Later on, it came into messaging. Later on, it became lots of different things where we found misuses of our technology. So when I was at LinkedIn, we kind of got ahead of it, and we had very strong policies on the rights and privileges of people that were allowed to use the platform, work with government agencies, work with people to make sure that the network stayed at a certain level, communicated a certain way. Everything is uplifting and everything is promoting good behavior. We didn't allow negative behavior. We didn't allow curse words, as an example. We didn't allow somebody to speak negatively. And because it was just removed from the network, it just became the way it was. And now you see the opposite in some other networks, where you just see like unpoliced, you know, when somebody just says, hey, we want to leave it too open, sometimes, you know, it perpetuates negativity. And I would go, well, yeah, there's a better way to do it. So anyway, that being said, I love this unique privilege here at Guardify, where we can serve child advocacy centers, prosecutors, public defenders, family protective services, you know, obviously our child advocacy customers who we love to death and we serve each and every day. So we're excited about the work that we get the privilege to do.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Ben, like you hit on this earlier too, right? Which is when like the idea of being able to come into a space with social impact and bring technology to bear in an aimed direction can be really like, it can unlock a ton of value. And this is where we see like a lot of the time industries, I think of like fintech, you know, I think of insurance, these industries that oftentimes are late adopters to technology, or they're still on the bus of like, I'm using technology, but it's 2-3 decades old and really clunky and I have to download it in order to use it. But there's this really awesome opportunity, you know, within our space to have, you know, a pointed set of outcomes towards a meaningful purpose, and then being able to bring in that technology. Which kind of hints a little bit, and you talked about this with like LinkedIn, right? It's really interesting, first of all, just to think you were at this massive place like LinkedIn before it was maybe what it is today. So there's probably a whole slew of learnings you had that were not just related to the product and to the organization, but to the entire space that LinkedIn fills. Maybe we dive in there at some point, but I'm also really interested to hear a little bit more about like your philosophy. So like, as you go through each of these iterations, and now you're coming into a space with, you know, with Guardify, obviously it takes a big team to build, you know, a business and a product and all those good things. But as a CEO, what is your philosophy and your approach to sort of building a world-class product and a company as we think about, you know, really making an impact in this space?
I think the world is at a unique place and time where we have this really interesting inflection point with new and innovative technology. And so we're right on this precipice of where you know, artificial intelligence is becoming something that just is almost a daily topic wherever you are, for whatever reason. Whatever application is, discriminative AI, generative AI, there's a lot of different ways to think about the future of this specific type of technology, which is not altogether different than other technologies that we've seen in the past. Where I think there's a unique, maybe an even more unique place right now in time, is kind of this influx in time of like, we're just now coming out of one of the world's largest pandemics, right? So we have these two major forces in the world. One is like changes in human behavior on how we operate, the way we trust other people, social isolationism, the way we think about modern medicine, the way we think about governments. And now we have this other piece, which is how do we think about technology? And so I think for us as an organization, and philosophically, one of the things I believe is very important right now is to create clarity and definition on where you want to go. And you can say, like, here's what is, here's the factors that we do not control. These, the ones I just mentioned, those are outside of our control. What is within our control? It's the way that we show up each and every day, the way we appreciate each other, the way we're intentionally building things. One of our core values that that I sort of brought into Guardify several months ago is this concept of how important today is. Today matters. And so our core value is called, we don't get to do today again. And it's intentionally stated to drive a little bit of urgency and a little bit of intentionality to say everything that you do matters. It matters to you, it matters to someone else, and it matters to the world at large. You can either choose to take the path of least resistance and go down the path of personal comfort and kind of just saying, like, I'm just going to do whatever it takes to make myself feel better and kind of isolate myself and do, you know, especially as Americans, we have this unique privilege of so many different things we can consume. Or you can choose the other path, which is the path of deciding each and every day, you're going to go contribute to society. You're going to create opportunities for other people. You're going to do hard things that are uncomfortable. You're going to go meet and talk to a stranger. You're going to find out what they need. And so for me and for us, I think it's kind of stems around that. It's just like being intentional in how we think about our impact on the world. Broader, there's lots of different ways to think about it. Like how do you think about creating financial opportunities at the same time as you think about social impact opportunities? How do you create a balance there? How do you make sure that you're like creating fulfillment for yourself through those efforts? How do you make sure that you're creating the opportunity for fulfillment for other people? But to me, it all kind of boils down to just like, we don't have a lot of time, right? And so like every day matters. And it comes out of some personal experiences for me personally. But as I brought it to the team, I was like, hey, this one really matters to me, that we're really, really intentional, that we define where we're going to go. We get everybody to talk about it, to just say like, hey, these are the things that we're going to agree to do. So these are the things we're going to agree not to do. And because we've agreed what we're not going to do, it allows us to be excellent at fewer things. And so we're going to pursue those. Yes, we are going to pursue some mind-blowing technology, like crazy things that the world hasn't even seen yet. That's going to happen. But I also think at the same time, we're going to be incredibly intentional about how it creates real meaningful value for the people that use our technology. And it's not just build a thing because you can build a thing. It's build a thing because you created it with intention for the other person, so that they can have a better life, better existence, do something more fulfilling because of what you created.
No, but Ben, I think that makes a lot of sense from that standpoint. In fact, I think in the last episode, one of the things I mentioned about why I wanted to come to Guardify was what you said, right? Which is, you know, you don't get to do today again, right? There's a lot of things we have. We all know this. We don't get time back. And so where we want to spend our time and where we want to invest our energy and what we have to bring to bear for the value of others and for the benefit of others really matters. And so, you know, that's what really excites me as well to be here at Guardify. But I also think, you know, you hit on this too with the technology standpoint. There's no shortage of not only technology, but new technology, new innovation, right? No code, low code. You think of all the ways that the landscapes are shifting, are going to continue to shift, not just from, you know, the big buzzword of AI, but from it, the tactical and practical things that are going to come from, you know, how engineering is taught, all sorts of things, right? And so there's no shortage of really, you know, the innovation and all the ideas. But what I think is really going to be that the thing that sticks around is people who are intentional about how to use all of that. And intentionality does require understanding, you know, what is the end outcome for leveraging technology? And for that matter, you know, one of the things we talk about on this podcast is we talk about technology. We talk about what that means for people, what that means for the processes that you have in place. So it goes beyond just technology. So it's one of those pillars. But again, I think it's really important to understand, you know, what's the holistic approach to applying those things. And that really forces you to understand, you know, real things like, hey, what are the problems you face today? And, you know, when I'm talking to customers, it's how can we help? How can we understand even on a layer deeper where the real pain is at in your workflow or what have you? So Ashley, I know you talk a lot to customers as well. Would you resonate with any of that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially that point of you don't get to do today again very deeply relates to the stuff that our customers deal with on a day-to-day basis. They're their challenges and their issues that they do try to solve on a regular basis change every single day. So us taking that approach and addressing their issues one day at a time, as if that is the number one priority each day, really, I think, impacts our point of view as we are continuing to develop what we work on.
So Ben, we talked about your story. I think what's important too is understanding that many of our listeners have an awareness of who Guardify is. You've already done a great job of kind of explaining some of the roots and how you came here. But maybe if we go all the way back, let's kick it back to the beginning. What is the origin story of VitaNix, now Guardify? Maybe just give us a little bit about how that came about, where we're at today, and sort of translate that, if you can, into where are we going in the future?
Yeah, I think so. Our history is such a wonderful blend of where we actually are now, because of this like interesting intersection between two organizations, Project Harmony, a very large child advocacy center in Omaha, Nebraska, and Giving Tech Labs, an incubator, a technology incubator program that came out of Seattle. And the origin story goes something like this, depending on who you ask. So Project Harmony had actually created their own initial attempt to go down this path. They had actually invested in some software to try to figure this out. But the problem in the world that they were trying to solve is when a child is abused and discloses abuse to an adult, in many communities across the country, they will have the unique opportunity to go to a child advocacy center where there's someone, a forensic interviewer, who is trained on asking questions to a child just to disclose what happened, if something happened. Their entire role is just to ask questions until they get to some version of the truth that the child can share with them. That's the intention. And so what happens is that interview itself is captured and recorded. So if you imagine there's like sort of like some of the videos we've seen on TV, that there's a camera up in the corner of a room and it's pointed down against to the child and pointed down to the forensic interviewer to record it and to capture it, to share it and use it as evidence. Well, what they'll do is they'll burn it on a DVD or on a USB drive. That is the way it has worked. If you think about the way most of us consume technology, that would be a foreign concept on our daily consumer behavior. But it's how it works in government. It's how it worked in child advocacy centers. And so what they had is an issue where a DVD was accidentally shared with the wrong person. That DVD was burned from the child advocacy center. It got to the wrong person. That wrong person used it as an abuse to the child. It was then brought before a judge. And the judge said to several folks in the courtroom, we have to do better. And that's where the original part of this started. Then, through this partnership that Giving Tech Labs had with a number of different agencies all over the country, including the Rakes Foundation, they found out about Project Harmony. And so they found out that, hey, there's some technology problems that we have. We think we can come and help. So Giving Tech Labs and the original co-founders that started this concept, Shelley Kurtz and Luis Salazar, came in and just said, hey, we think we can help. Let it allow us to build a quick and dirty beta version of what this would look like using cloud-based technology and powered by AI. And that's going back about 6.5 years ago now, 7 years ago. When they went through this discovery process, they found out a couple of things were really, really important. Number one, as it is inferred, the storage and shared access controls were absolutely critical. This can never go to the wrong person. And so they had to make sure that they created those things within the technology. Then they kind of took pieces of that and said, hey, we actually need to be able to play this back on a browser so that someone can play it and they can view it so it can be consumed by another person, shared, control the access, allow somebody else to play it. And then we added on different features like the ability to clip and modify the video, add notes associated with different, associated with different things. Kind of from there, they brought it out into the market and they said, hey, does anybody want to invest in this thing? Because we actually think we have a pretty cool business model that is sustainable, that like a lot of these centers exist in the United States. At that point, there was like 950 of them. Today, there's almost 1,200. And they have this use case and it's not going away. The addition of video in the world, if you think about 6-7 years ago, the amount of video was then to where it is today, it's easily multitudes higher than it was then. And so they kind of said, hey, there's this unique opportunity. They at that point brought in Sarah Boyd, who used to be the CEO of Omaha Community Foundation, leading a very large organization that did philanthropic work throughout the Omaha and Nebraska community. She took the company, kind of went, okay, I think we can take this model and we can grow it. We can get lots and lots of child advocacy centers. I have lots of connections. Let's start to build some of these relationships. Let's start to add new features and functions over the course of time. So fast forward a little bit of time to where we are today. We decided that the story needed to be reshaped as we kind of changed the vision of the company. And we said, originally, we were just set out to serve child advocacy centers. That was the vision. It was, let's figure out how can we do this. Then as it expanded, we realized as an organization, actually, there's lots of these technological challenges throughout the justice ecosystem. There's lots of different times where someone's using a physical hardware to manage critical evidence. It's being put on a USB, a DVD, a server. It's being put on a drive that's being shared with someone else. It's even being shared in some non-secured virtual ways over email and other ways that are just not safe, not secure. Lots of folks don't actually know the complications of that security. So that being said, then we kind of moved into these other spaces where we realized like our number one user on Guardify today is law enforcement. And after that is defense and prosecution and family protective services, not just the child advocacy center. In fact, the child advocacy center is one of the lower usage types on our platform. It's not a lot of them actually. Of our 60,000 users, we found that like supporting all of these free users was a really important thing that we needed to do. And as we started to have all of these free users who had different use cases, we built additional features and functions for those user groups. And so it kind of made sense to go, okay, well, we originally were just solving this problem. So the name made sense. Vita, the kind of the original part of the name, Vita means life. Nyx is this Greek goddess of power who also saved a number of children. So if you kind of put it together, it was like bringing life to protecting children. And that was kind of the story. Well, as it changed and we realized actually there's other use cases where our technology applies that's outside of just child advocacy centers. Now it's into domestic violence. And now it's into other types of crime. And now it's into other types of applications that we didn't originally envision. And so the name changed going back to the beginning of this year. It's 2024. We're freshly minted only a few months ago as Guardify. And the purpose was to be more clear. And it was going, let's tell people what we do and let's make it very simple and obvious. So there's not quite so many questions when you're talking to a law enforcement professional or you're talking to somebody who's in prosecution to go, hey, I know you want to use this in court, but you're going to have to get over this hurdle of a weird name thing that shows up on a page that somebody doesn't know what it is. Whereas if you go into that same courtroom and say, hey, let's put this on the screen as Guardify, it raises fewer questions. Sometimes words matter, and just like the intention behind those words matters a great deal. So that's where we are today. We currently serve, as I mentioned, almost over 60,000 users on the platforms, 13,000 agencies, including those ones I mentioned, child advocacy centers, prosecution, public defense, family protective services, a number of other agencies across a multitude of agencies using our platform for different services, including health professionals, including now even going into some mental health use cases. We also now have a series of products that are designed to help speed up and have live presentations just like this, where someone can be talking live to someone being interviewed or somebody who needs to be on that call, but it also needs to be highly protective and it's a very sensitive interview. So for us, the future is really interesting, but kind of that's where we are today. It's like this unique blend of a problem found in the world of Project Harmony, direct service providers, people that were serving, the victims of abuse each and every day, to technologists, giving tech labs who came in and said, hey, we think we can understand how to make this work better for just the technological purposes. We can't get rid of the problem, but we can at least make the problem not get worse. And how can we at least like solve this part first? And then we can work on what are those next things, which I think is just, for me, it's always like, it's a wonderful lens to have started with because it's the same lens that we still run our organization through. It's how do we create world-class experiences using technology to serve direct service providers?
So part of what you mentioned related heavily to how buried our user base is related specifically to law enforcement and how many more law enforcement users we have than we probably initially anticipated. But what I think was really important with the expansion of our platform is how integrated each of those agencies has become and how we've kind of helped bridge the gap between each agency and get their workflow more streamlined and bring them together in more of a community sense. So can you tell us a little bit more about your idea around connected communities and what that means for you?
Yeah, so the term connected communities came out of a discussion we had several months ago, probably going back in September, October 2023, when we started talking about the importance of this simple function that, like, we all sort of take for granted on social platforms, on technology, and you'll notice it as soon as I say it. It's this share button. It's the ability to share with another person, which automatically connects them to you in some way. In many ways, it can be one way, right? I'm just going to share it with you. I want you to go deal with this now, right? I'm sharing this with you. I emailed it to you, and so it's completed. I sent you the file. I shared it with you, so now it's your responsibility, no longer mine. And what we found to be true is, what's interesting, as soon as it's shared, there's actually another person oftentimes that needs to be shared that same information. And so, which is why we got into this, like, addictive behavior that the world has today of, like, posting on social media. Because we didn't want to just send it to a friend who then sends it to a friend who then sends it to a friend and then sends it to a friend. And, like, you've got this weird game of telephone. We wanted to share it for everybody. And so it sort of stemmed out of this construct of, like, saying, hey, the Child Advocacy Center, who's sort of at the beginning of the first part of our organization, was they capture this video. They have to share it with multiple parties, right? They have to share it with the prosecution. They have to share with defense. They have to share it with Family Protective Services. They have to share with law enforcement. What if we started to look at each of those different agencies and each of those different user types as another person who had a similar problem, but maybe looking at it from a different lens? As an example, law enforcement may gather a lot more information that enriches that same case. They may go on site and see something at that home. They may take have a written document that shares, like, here's my report that I'll share with someone else that needs to be shared. And as we started, like, unravel this ball of yarn that was around this simple construct around sharing, it became very clear that, like, the most important thing was looking at every relationship within the justice ecosystem and realizing the ability to share bidirectionally. I share with you, you can share back with me, or you can share to multiple, but you have the access controls. You decide who gets what based on your jurisdiction, based on your agency, based on what your process is. And we started to realize, like, this is actually a way to connect people, just like social networks did, but in a safer, more compliant, more regulated industry, where we just went, okay, what if we connected communities, but we intentionally created a series of controls that just went, this person can share with this person, this person can share a limited version of that with someone else, or this person can simply say, I've got it. No one else needs to know. But our construct was around just creating a business architecture that allowed for all of these different people to access the right evidence at the right time to make the right decision to make sure that there's the right outcome. So that's where it all stemmed from. Since then, I just randomly talk about connected communities, and I talk about, like, this future vision that I love, it, which, like, just makes me happy and smile every day, which is this future state where we build trust in the justice system. Because they know that evidence doesn't get lost, that law enforcement can be trusted, that justice can be properly served, because we know things don't get lost. Because eventually we can start to see trends across the evidence itself. And we can actually start to say, these are the things that most likely happened in these locations, and we can actually create services that would help this community more effectively, whether it be in the case of abuse, parenting techniques, different ways to make sure that your children feel safe and protected, training for educators, training for support staff, folks that are in all of these different agencies that kind of work and surround children, whether it's Child Protective Services, whether it's at daycares, just saying these are the things that are the indicators of abuse, or these are the things that actually go the opposite direction and end the cycle entirely. But we can see them in pockets, and we can provide those to our local agencies. So that's part of it. I think the next is just creating free and open applications that are available to every member of society, and just saying, hey, did you witness a crime? Did you witness something that didn't feel right, didn't seem right, but you don't quite know what to do with it? Rather than just call 911, which may or may not be the right thing to do, here's an alternative solution. Capture it, record it, and that way you have it ready for you when that is needed. So if someone in your community, law enforcement, we believe should actually, like, you know, be able to make their own decisions. We're not going to say, like, let's overwhelm the system by all this information that's coming from private citizens. We're going to say, like, hey, you choose the controls that you want to have. but just know your community trusts you. And your community is there to make sure that you have the right information when you need that right that information to enforce the law as you see fit.
Yeah. I think what's really powerful about all that too is, you know, there's a few things in there that are like, I consider like maybe core tenets or core pillars, right? One is the ability to share is important, but there's a lot of solutions out on the market and a lot of them being used in these spaces where you can share, but it's not exactly secured, right? Or there's not that maybe extra layer of security where you have a high degree of confidence. Like this is really truly secured platform. So security is a, an important pillar that I think Guardify handles really well, but also to your other point, it's not just sharing, right? It's sharing with the ability to, you know, have high level of control over what gets shared, when it gets shared, how long it gets shared. And then built on top of that, which I think is also really exciting that you talked about is, you know, you kind of work from the foundation of a secure platform where everything that's going into it is secured. And then you build on top of that. Okay, now how do we make more sense of that type of evidence? What is that full ecosystem and the life cycle of that evidence? And how is how does the tooling help complement and ultimately make someone's day a little bit easier who's trying to pursue, you know, whether it's a prosecutor trying to put together the case, whether it's law enforcement looking at a video, trying to ensure that they get just the facts or, you know, what have you, whatever type of evidence that is. So that's really, yeah, that's really interesting. And I don't know that I've heard you talk about connected communities that way. So that's really cool. Like you said, I think it's an awesome, it's awesome to hear you go through that.
Along with connected communities, I think that comes with a lot of focus on supporting these industries and these agencies that we work with. And I think that has a lot to do with what we see as challenges or issues that direct service providers have in the industry. Do you want to talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are, what you see in direct services, primarily related to maybe attrition rates?
There's a softball if I ever heard one. I love it. So, yes, I think the biggest challenge beyond beyond just general burnout, because you can stay employed but disengaged, you know, relatively easy, and even in the direct service industry, right? You can show up and do your job. You can check the boxes. You can complete your tasks. But the number one challenge that we continue to hear from our customers is hiring and maintaining and retaining incredibly talented people, right? Because the jobs that they do, they're hard. They're complicated. They're taxing. There's so much secondary trauma that they have to go through, right? You're spending all day long listening to terrible things, observing terrible things, protecting yourself from terrible things, trying to protect your community, going into places where people run away from. And so it's just this group of incredible people from the forensic interviewers who are interviewing victims of abuse to law enforcement. I think we know a fair amount about all of the different challenges that they face on a daily basis. To all of our litigation professionals, prosecution, defense, who are going through these things every day and become jaded to them. And eventually there's just an easier solution than showing up to work and going, I just want to go do this in a different place or do it a different way or go somewhere where it's not so insert terrifying statement here, right? I don't want to go deal with trauma again tomorrow. I don't want to have to deal with another child that was abused. I don't want to go show up to another murder scene. I don't want to go have to prosecute somebody who I know did this or I believe did that. I don't want to go into that space anymore. And so that attrition rate is very high. And as we're starting to look at different ways that we can support all of our agencies, one of those places that we do see an opportunity to at least create a little bit of light in sometimes a dark place is the technology that they experience. And so there's nothing worse that you can go through. Like if you think about your own day and you go through, like, there's a system somewhere on your computer or on your phone that you have to log into that, you know, I have to do this because it's my job, but I hate it. I don't like it. It doesn't look like it was built for me. It doesn't look like somebody actually paid attention to the type of use case that I have. It looks like it was written by somebody who was like just trying to sell a thing to a person, right? And I don't like that. We aspire to be the opposite. We aspire to go like, look, we know your job is stressful. We understand the day-to-day taxes that you go through, the emotional tax, sometimes the financial tax, right? Sometimes you have to compromise your own economic well-being to go do some of these jobs. And at the very least, it's our duty as technologists who work in this space to create world-class experiences. so that when you have to go do the details of your job, sit behind a screen, sit behind a mobile device, sit behind a tablet, you can at least say, there's at least one thing that I get to do on a daily basis that doesn't make me angry. That's a technology that was built for me that does the things it's supposed to do. Because I can tell there's so much intentionality behind the way that just flowed with how I have to do my job, that it just made sense. And thank you, Guardify, or other technology platforms in our space in digital evidence management, that are spending a lot of time with users and really spending time to figure out, how does the user need to use this technology? We use the word user, which means somebody that interacts with our technology, somebody that's logged into the application, can see how it all works, and it just makes sense. And they can just go, thank you. That's so much better. And so we believe that, like, even if it's a small part, that investment in technology, especially when it's simple, easy to use, easy to understand, goes a long way to showing someone, hey, we get you. We understand. We care. Does it mean that there's a direct correlation to employee retention? Probably not. But we believe it's another way to just say, hey, we get it. We understand what you're going through. We understand the challenges of your role. We want you to be able to do it as efficiently and effectively as humanly possible, knowing what you just had to go through. And so we're going to try to alleviate some of that stress by not making you have to go, why do I have to do this thing again? Or why do I have to click this 17 times? Or why do I keep getting logged out? Or why do I have to, all of those why do I's, let's get rid of those and let's create, you know, world-class technology that alleviates that stress point.
I think it's a very sober-minded approach, Ben, like what you just talked about, because it's sober-minded in the fact that we, you know, as a company, as somebody building a product, understand a few core things that are really important. One is there's things we can change and there's things we can't change. You know, we can't exactly influence hiring. We can't exactly influence the opinions, whether it's a social, you know, a larger social opinion that's going on, or something that's going on directly within an office. We can't, in other words, we don't have control over who gets hired, how long they stay, or for that matter, what it looks like when you talk about succession planning and how different people are coming in and out, how to make sure things transition over. I do think there's interesting ways that technology can help there. But the point is, the sober-minded approach says there's things we can control, there's things we can't. One of the things we know we can help with is making your day-to-day life a little bit easier when you interact with the technology. That's an important pillar. But the other one that you hit at that I think is really, really important, and I think we also have to be, we have to take a humbled approach to how we build a product this way, which is we can empathize with how someone using the technology uses it in their day, right? We can say, what is the problem you're having? And how are you, you know, how does this helping or not helping? But there is a level, unless we've done that, you just don't get it. And I think we've all had this moment in life where you're doing something, you're trying to explain it to somebody, and you know, I could sit here and try to tell you, but I'm kind of going to talk till I'm blue in the face and you're probably not going to get it. And so one of the things Ashley and I talked about last week, and I think this is really important for companies building in this space, is to have people within your four walls who do have that experience as well, right? Where appropriate, being able to say, hey, we actually have people who are forensic interviewers who are helping us understand that. We have people who are former prosecutors, and we're not just relying on that though. That's a complemented approach to when we're talking with our customers, with our users, as you said, on how we think about those things. So yeah, I think that's a really great approach. I'm really interested, Ben, everybody, let's get to the topic that everybody in their world is talking about on every podcast for the most part in technology, which is AI. So could you talk a little bit, maybe a few things here. One is there a need to fear it or embrace it? How should people be thinking about that who are in our space? And then maybe just talk a little bit about how you see that impacting whether, you know, Guardify as a product and what we want to, like some of the ideas and things we want to go after, or just generally in this space. Maybe just riff on that and talk through that.
So it's a great question, Myron. So artificial intelligence has been around for a very long time. I think where we're oftentimes reactionary to is this like unique consumer grade application of a technology that changes our ability to think about it. So as an example, ChatGPT is the one that most recently came out that like sort of transformed the adoption curve for AI, or like gave this like real life everyday application that we could talk about, right? It's been in our back pockets for a long time. It's actually in your pocket, your actual real pocket for a long time, right? We've had Siri, we've had Alexa, we've had all of these different applications, you had Cortana, you've had all of these different artificial intelligence applications in our lives every single day for years, and we didn't fully recognize it as AI. We didn't fully talk about it the same way we're talking about ChatGPT, DALL-E, OpenAI, all of these different things. I think the general framework that I look at with all technology is what is the right use case for the application of the tool? So like artificial intelligence is going to have lots and lots of really great world-changing applications. It's also going to have lots of nefarious applications that people are going to conjure up that are going to be terrible, because that's sort of human nature, right? We have a tendency to look at an application and go, I wonder if I can do the thing. And at first you start on down a good enough path, and then eventually like there's a left-hand turn and nobody corrected you and went, hey, don't do that. So I think that's kind of like part one is like, hey, it's just another tool. It's another variation of a tool. Where I think there's a general opportunity for education, I don't know about fear, it's more on an education standpoint, is really understanding what goes on behind the artificial intelligence itself. What are the models that it's using to learn? To me, the opportunity to make sure that anyone who's like digging into what is the value of artificial intelligence, it's just really looking at where did it get its information to begin with? Where's the origin of that information coming from that's, you know, spitting out this result? There's also the secondary part of it, which is like the first phase of AI was really this ability to discriminate information. It was discriminative AI. It was like the ability to take these large swaths of information and try to figure out what it was looking at, trying to figure out what it was saying, trying to understand your voice, your tone, your inflection, your accent, et cetera, for audio, different contexts for actually like adding text and different things that happen with ChatGPT. And then there's this next version, which is its generative function, its ability to produce something, which is what we're seeing with ChatGPT, which is like, hey, I have all this information that's sitting in this database that I've pulled, that I have, that has some inferences of accuracy, bring in some new context, ask a question, make a statement, ask for an output, and I can take this this information and I can generate something new from it. And so like that's what we're seeing right now is like, at first it was just help me decipher this. Now it's, hey, give me an output that's based on this information. Neither good nor bad, just different. And so I think it's just like looking at the tool, does this create value? The phase of concern that I have in this is like, once you create a loop, once you go discriminate, tell me what this is, create a new thing, then do you allow it to discriminate again? And that's actually where the challenge is coming up. It's like, okay, well, should you allow AI to discriminate itself and actually like build its own loop back to say, hey, here's the output, analyze your output, build a new output. Like that's where the place is like, well, without controls in place, without people paying attention to what it was putting out, lots of different unintended consequences will happen. Some we know, some we don't. In fact, most we don't. A funny story, a friend of mine was actually using AI for their online chatbot. It's like this online, they put it on their customer support application. They just trained what they thought was this brilliant artificial intelligence tool to answer all of their customers' questions. They're just like, we don't need people anymore. And all of a sudden, they had this massive amount of customers leave. They churned, they canceled accounts, and they couldn't figure out why. They lost $20 million through this process of like training an AI bot to just like figure out what people were saying. Well, the problem that they found is that like the AI bot taught itself that the path of least resistance was giving a customer a refund. And so it just automatically would create this loop that would go, hey, I have a problem. And the bot would say, great, let me give you a refund. And they would, and it just created massive amounts of cancellations, massive amounts of downgrades, all this stuff. And it was just like one of those, like, be careful what you accidentally create.
Right.
And don't just allow something to go create something and then not monitor it and not understand it. Right. So for us, that's the place that we look at is how do we make sure that we're paying attention to how we want that information controlled, how we want that information consumed, and how we want to make sure we share it with someone else unaudited. So I think like the funny thing that we're hearing for children in school in particular is like, should you be allowed to use artificial intelligence to create content in school, right? Write a paper, you know, help you do your homework, et cetera. And the way that I've shared it with my children, not everybody's not going to agree with me on this, but I was like, it doesn't hurt to have a secondary set of information that you can learn from, but still use your brain. Like you've gone through, you did the homework, allow it to generate something. So at least like you can get out of analysis paralysis. You can't generate the first sentence. You can't get past the first page, et cetera. Give yourself an idea. Ah, that's a different way to look at it. Or, ooh, that's horrible. I don't want to do that. But at least like continue using your brain to discriminate what you want versus what the output is. Like that's where the human intentionality has to come in. And it's not just, you know, saying, hey, my professor said I need a 500 page or I need a 500 word document that's on the Civil War output. It's not that. It's being able to say, hey, here's my context. Here's the things that I've learned. Here's what I really want to understand. Here's what I think I want to do now. You know, give me something to get me out of writer's block or give me some new output that I can figure out if it makes sense, if it's correct, if it makes, you know, if it does a better job than what I thought the first time, and then I'm going to modify it. I'm going to try to decide what makes the most sense now. So I don't think AI is good or bad. I think it is one of those opportunities for great technology professionals, consumers of technology, anybody who's using a digital device today, to know what they're looking at and to be informed and to know like, hey, this is what it's doing and this is what I'm okay with. Because like every family, every person, every dad, every mom, every child, everybody in the workplace is going to have a different variation of what they believe is okay, is an acceptable use of that. I think there's definitely going to be opportunities for legislation. There's going to be lots of opportunities for different financial opportunities for folks. I think that's like why you see this influx in AI companies. We're also going to look back on this in 10 years and go, how much of that really made any sense?
Right.
Right. How much of that were we really looking at it eyes wide open? Or were we just saying somebody said AI, therefore it must be great? Or it says AI, therefore it must be terrible. We're going to look back at it and go, how did we not see where this was going and create some boundaries in place to say, hey, just because we can do a thing doesn't mean we should. Right. Here's what we believe is the moral construct by which we build technology.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, Ben, like you mentioned, you know, I think we can all sit here and say it's neither good nor bad, right? It's really how you apply it. And that's going to be what's really important. And also to be thinking, you know, to your point too, there's going to be legislation and things that come and change in the space. And on this podcast, we hope this is a context that we continue to invite different people from different perspectives and experience in that space to speak to. So thanks for providing your experience or your perspective rather on that. Any other topics we want to cover before we wrap up, guys? Any thoughts on your head?
There's an opportunity to always create a platform for civil discourse. And I think like this platform, I love this, you know, I love podcasts and that ability, right? You're going to get lots of guests that have two different views on the same thing, right? And both can actually be true at the same time, right? Like you're going to have someone that's going to say, we fear AI because of all of the terrible things it can do, right? That's one way to look at it. It's the same way you could have looked at machine learning. It's the same way you could look at blockchain technology. It's the same way you could look at the internet in general. You actually can survive in today's society without the internet. It's possible, I've heard. I don't know anybody, but I've heard it's true. And so I think like you can have a headed in the sand mentality and say, fear all, because all technology is evil. Or you can have the opposite approach, which is the kind of the unregulated, unfiltered, we all have the right to every technology and everything in the world. And there's two different opposing views on this in most cases. And I would say like it's actually somewhere between the two. What I think is like going to be this principled approach to any adoption of new technology is deciding what's the framework by which we think is like operationally acceptable. So like in the United States, we have a constitution, we have a series of laws that happen in every jurisdiction. We say like these are the parameters by which we operate. As long as those are known, well communicated and consistent, I think you can choose which side you're on. You can say these are the frameworks by which you operate. Here at Guardify, we have some frameworks that we operate on that are just like very similar, but we bring it down a level that's like more of a day-to-day application. Like we're HIPAA compliant as an example that says these are the parameters by which we abide by. We follow this protocol because we believe that personal privacy protection is really, 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 really important. And so these are the ways that we're going to operate using technology. We're also CJIS ready. So we follow what's the FBI's protocol for how they want information to be secured and protected. So we say like, as long as we stay within these guardrails, under these frameworks, and then as an organization here at Guardify, we follow under beneath our shared mission, our shared vision, our core values, and the things that we've said are really, really important to us, as long as we stay within those boundaries and along with those guidelines, there's a lot of flexibility that we have. There's a lot of things we can test. There's a lot of things we can learn. As long as we protect everybody, as long as we follow the process, and as long as we prioritize things effectively. I think that same thing is true in any adoption of tech, is you go like, hey, was crypto the right answer to the new, you know, the new way to manage money? No, it depends on who you ask, right? It for some, yes, for some, no. For some of us, we're just kind of looking at it going, I still don't entirely understand it. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me of like, how does this, you know, how does this stay consistent? How does this not fluctuate so much? How does this, you know, all of these different parameters, how do you use a computing source to generate, you know, a monetary amount? I don't quite understand that, because I don't quite understand it. I choose to just listen and learn, but I don't participate. I think the same thing could be true with AI. You can say, I choose to just listen and observe, but I'm not going down this path as a profession, or I don't want to, you know, I don't want to consume so many things that are using AI. Or if I don't know what models they're using or how they're gathering that information or enriching those models. So one thing for us at Guardify that's really, really important is, in any model we use, we have to protect the information of our users. And so in many models, what'll happen is, in order for the model to get more intelligent, you have to feed it back the outputs. And you say, hey, like as an example in transcription, if it outputs specific words and you say those words are incorrect, you send it back to the model, and the next time the model sees that same pattern, it will change it and will upgrade it to whatever you said. Well, in our context, we don't send it back to the model, because that information is not ours to share. That information belongs to our users and is highly protected. And that's actually like a really interesting boundary line as technologists, because we're going, well, it would make it so much better. But at the same time, we're going, which matters more to us, the protection of privacy and the protection of that person's story, or the technology? And we've answered it. Our answer is, their privacy is way more important than our ability to update an algorithm. And so, like, we're going to protect that. And I think that's just like one example of a boundary line that we've created ourselves. We still wish that we could make it better, but we're going to do that a series of different ways. They're actually much more complex. They're more expensive, but they're the right thing to do.
Right.
And so for us, it's like, these are the boundary lines that we've decided. Therefore, this use case of AI is inappropriate for us. We're going to do it a different way.
Right. And like you said, it's not that they can't get better. It's that the path to making them better is probably just a little more complex, requires a little bit more steps, right? So that's really interesting. Yep. Well, Ben, this has been great. We really appreciate you. Before we part ways, I'm wondering if you could offer just a word of encouragement, something that you want our listeners to hear directly from you.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for this opportunity. So there's a couple things. One is, like, don't fear technology. Understand it, consume it, like, learn about it, spend some time on the internet really understanding how it works, from cloud-based computing to how transcription services work and AI works, blockchain technology a little bit. Like, in your spare time, if you're bored, or like, find a technology company like us that nerds out about it and likes to talk about it and talk to us. The second is actually way, way, way more important. And that's, we are so grateful for the opportunity to serve child advocacy centers and forensic interviewers. The work that you do means so much to us that we created our own annual event to celebrate you. It's called Forensic Interviewers Week. And here's what it is. It's bringing awareness in our community. So what is a child advocacy center? What do you do? How does this actually work? What are the day-to-day tasks that a child forensic interviewer does that serves the community? Because it's oftentimes one of those that, like, if you show up to a dinner party and you tell somebody that I'm a forensic interviewer, the conversation kind of fades. No one knows what to do with that. Right? It's sort of like we have in our unique environment where we go like, hey, I work for this digital evidence management company. No one knows what to do with that. And we go like, well, here's how this works. Here's what we do and all that. So as our way to say, hey, we really want to make sure that you're celebrated well, that you're recognized for the work that you do. We celebrate every July Forensic Interviewer Week. This is our third annual Forensic Interviewer Week. We have a number of different awards that we're giving out. That we would love people to go out and nominate folks in the industry for, from Forensic Interviewer of the Year Award to Partner of the Year Award to Champion for Children Awards to the Child Advocacy Leader Award. There's like a series of awards that we offer just for this industry. We want to make sure it's recognized, the incredible work that you do. Not to say there aren't lots and lots of other people that deserve an incredible amount of credit, an incredible amount of honor and recognition. We just have this unique vantage point on seeing all of these child advocacy centers across the country. Roughly one third of them now are using Guardify in one way, shape, or form or another. And we just want to make sure we say thank you. Please continue the work that you're doing. It means so much more than you may even realize to not only the person that you're serving, but also breaking that cycle of the children who are abused. Roughly 30% of them will go on to abuse their own children. And so like our objective as far as technology goes is like, how can we at least like start to break this cycle through technology? How can we break this cycle through incredible service providers? How can we break these cycles of abuse by just bringing awareness to the people that are doing the work, showing people how to find resources, knowing what this looks like, what are the signals? And for us, Forensic Interviewer Week is just a unique privilege and opportunity for us to talk all about child abuse, all about the workers in child abuse, all about forensic interviewers. So if you're listening to this podcast, please go look for National Forensic Interviewers Week, sponsored by, I think, Guardify. I don't know if we're sponsored, if we just like are the ones that like made this a thing, but please go find out about it. Please make sure you have all of the support that you need in your own communities. And if there's anything that we can be doing for you, please let us know. That is what we are here for.
Awesome. Yep. And on that note, just check the show notes for this podcast. There'll be links, everything that Ben mentioned. You can certainly go there. We'll make sure that you have everything you need just to click and go check it out. Ben, again, thank you so much for taking the time to come chat with us.
Anytime. I'm so excited about this podcast.
Likewise.
Thanks, Myra. Thanks, Ashley.
Awesome. Well, if you've listened this far, it's likely that you're a fan of this type of content. So please consider subscribing. You can find this podcast on any platform where you find all of your normal podcasts. You can also check us out at www.guardify.com/podcast. And if you're interested at all in getting a demo of Guardify as a platform or product that might be a fit for your office, you can check out our website, www.guardify.com, or feel free to email sales@guardify.com. Thanks so much for listening.